Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Dr. Eric Plakin joins us today to respond to your questions and comments. He comes to us from the Austin Riggs Center in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, where he is the Associate Medical Director, Director of Admissions. He's a prolific author and lecturer, formerly a Harvard Medical School clinical faculty member, a guy who really has been around in the major, major leagues of psychiatric medicine. Dr. Plakin earned his medical degree from the Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons. He worked as a rural general practitioner in Vermont before completing a psychiatric residency at Dartmouth and a fellowship in advanced fellowship in psychoanalytic psychotherapy at Austin Riggs. He's a distinguished life fellow of the American Psychiatric Association and leads its psychotherapy caucus. Eric Plakin, Dr. Plakin, thanks so much for being here.
Nice to be back, Alan.
Well, we always like it when you're here. And for those who are thinking about calling, there is a wide range of subjects. There are medicines, there's psychotherapy, there's talk therapy, and there is a whole lot of questions you can ask. And Eric Plakin is one of the few guys who can answer them all. Because he is a real expert in what is available. So, if I were to ask you, medicine versus talk therapy these days, Eric, what's the scene look like?
Medicine versus talk therapy is exactly the problem. It's both and, not either or. And I think that in the last couple of decades, at least my profession, psychiatry, and the larger American culture, has sort of drifted in the direction of viewing all problems as solvable by a pill, as if human beings were mostly receptor sites for molecules. And I think that's, that despite the powerful advances we've made in psychopharmacology, that the evidence that's emerging is that environmental factors, nurture as compared to nature,
sure,
play a really important role in the causation and I think then arguably in the treatment of mental disorders. I think that, we hoped that once we decoded the human genome, that we would find the genes for mental disorders, but regardless of whether you're looking at schizophrenia, where there's over 128 genetic loci identified, or whether you're looking at depression, where we can't seem to find any meaningful small bits of DNA that show a genetic linkage, clearly there's some what's called heritable component. Clearly, there's a genetic component, but this is not like eye color. This is not like height. This is highly complex, and there's the new term is not genetics. It's epigenetics.
Will we get there? In other words, right now, for example, take the BRAT gene and cancer, breast cancer, that kind of thing. It seems to many of us it's just a matter of time till they get it all right. And one wonders whether or not, based on what you've just said, one has the reason to be optimistic.
Well, there's so much embedded in what you're saying. The BRAT gene winds up being a vulnerability gene. If you've got that gene, it shows a vulnerability to developing certain cancers. Now, in psychiatry, we may find that, but we have to watch out for narrow preconceived notions that it's all about vulnerability. I heard on this radio station a wonderful story a bit less than a year ago about Dame Gillian Lynn. And it was she's a world famous choreographer and award winner, Broadway royalty. You on this radio station told the story of how she seemed to be a hyperactive little girl. She's now in her 80s and highly successful and still dancing. As a child, her mother was concerned about how fidgety she was and brought her to a doctor. And the doctor looked at this little girl sitting on her hands, trying to keep still. And he said to the mother, "Ma'am, let's step out of the office." They did. He flipped on his radio. And this little girl, 6 or 7 years old, started dancing all over the doctor's office, on the examining table, on his desk, all over the place. And the doctor didn't turn to the mother and say, "Oh, your daughter has vulnerability for attention deficit disorder, this doctor said, oh, your daughter's a dancer. Get her dancing lessons. And so what I'm talking about here is the notion that if we focus too much on vulnerability, we may be looking too narrowly at something that may be more about plasticity.
I'm a little confused here, Eric, in terms of the words. Vulnerability means that we've identified, in one case, a gene, and it says you are at risk for getting this in ways other people aren't, right?
Right.
And plasticity?
Well, you know, so plasticity means it's not just a vulnerability. For example, and this is still under some debate, but it's a fascinating area of research in genetics. People tend to know about the drugs that are serotonin reuptake inhibitors. People tend to know that serotonin is involved, we think, in some ways in mood disorders. And there's a gene is called the serotonin transporter promoter gene. It determines how much reuptake pump, if you will, is naturally present in you. And there are two forms of that gene. Two different kinds of so-called alleles, if you remember your high school biology.
I do not.
Okay. Well, you know, so you can have a short allele and a long allele, or two short alleles or two long alleles in the genetic makeup of these people. And without worrying about understanding all that, here's the important message. The people with short alleles, in the face of early adverse experiences in their life, maltreatment, sexual trauma, those people look like they have a vulnerability gene because they're more likely to develop depression. Except that if you look at the full graph of all the data, it's not just that the people with the short alleles are more vulnerable and the people with the long alleles are more resistant. It's also the case that in the absence of early adverse experiences, the people with the short alleles do the best overall. So wait a minute. Should we be thinking vulnerability? Or should we be thinking plasticity? In the presence of adverse environmental circumstances, people with this genetic endowment have a bad outcome. But in the presence of enriched environmental experiences, they have an optimal outcome.
Interesting. Well, 1-800-348-2551. We're lucky to have this particular expert right here with us, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on.
What's your opinion on the serotonin reuptake inhibitors as opposed to placebo? And I might add, how prevalent is tardive dyskinesia?
Huh. Okay, thanks, Jim.
And for the rest of the world, Eric, if you would just sort of clue us in as to what's being asked here.
Sure. Well, here's what I think I understand Jim to be asking. A class of drugs, I've already made reference to it, are the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, also known as SSRIs. Common examples, their brand names are things like Celexa and Prozac and Lexapro. And these are used in anxiety and in depression. Jim's also mentioned tardive dyskinesia, which is a side effect. It's sometimes seen with these SSRIs. It's more typical with some of the older antipsychotic drugs. And I'll just define it and then go back to the SSRIs, which is what the question's about mostly. When people take some of the older antipsychotic drugs like Haldol or Trilofan, they can have muscle problems, motor problems, tremors, or other kinds of slowing that happen while they're taking the drug. But tardive means late. Dyskinesia means abnormal movement. You can also develop a late syndrome of abnormal movements if you've been on those drugs for a while that often turns up with changes in the mouth and tongue movements. That's what tardive dyskinesia is. It's not commonly associated with SSRIs. It's not impossible, but it's not the most common thing that you look for. When you raise the question of SSRIs versus placebo, Jim is touching on a very interesting piece of learning over the last decade. Now, the SSRIs are excellent antidepressant and anti-anxiety medications. When people test them, what they do is they take some people and they find someone who, say, has a pure case of depression, and they break that group into half people getting, say, Prozac and half people getting a placebo, a sugar pill,
right.
And they see the difference. And two interesting facts. Number one, the SSRI is better than placebo, but 75% of its effect is from the placebo. 75% of the effect of the active drug is the same as what you'd get from the placebo.
And you know that how?
By looking at the research and seeing how did the placebo responders do and how did the active drug responders do.
Well, we know the active drug responders did better than the placebo.
We know that they scored, let's say, 100 on a test of how much they improved.
I see.
And the placebo people scored 75.
Interesting.
So there's an additional 25%. And it turns out that the only studies that were being published were the ones that showed a beneficial effect for the SSRI.
Because the drug companies?
The drug companies or the journals didn't want to publish a no-finding-here study. It's called the file-drawer phenomenon. There's now a requirement that all trials be registered. And when you look at all trials, we also learn we've overestimated the efficacy of these drugs by about a third.
Okay.
It doesn't mean they don't work, but they don't work as well as we thought.
Okay, listen, Jim, thanks for the call. Let me say the phones are lighting up. We have two free phones if you want to get on. Three are up. We'll be talking to Lola and to Janie and to others, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing inpatient and outpatient care for New York's Capital Region. Reinventing healthcare one patient at a time, ellismedicine.org. United Way of the Greater Capital Region, Albany, New York. Live united, give, advocate, volunteer, unitedwaygcr.org. The Ashokan Center, a classroom in the wild where nature inspires conferences, festivals, family celebrations, and outdoor education for schools, ashokancenter.org. Evoke Style in Stuyvesant Plaza, specializing in women's clothing, shoes, handbags, accessories, gifts, and more, evokestyle.com. Project Native, Route 41, Housatonic, Massachusetts, a plant nursery and wildlife sanctuary offering over 200 species of native plants and perennial seed mixes. Open daily, projectnative.org for information. And from Stewart Shops, we are closer to you with over 3,000 different items to choose from.
And we are here. You can call us at 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Right now you won't get in because every phone is taken. I'm not surprised, with Dr. Eric Plakin, one of the great experts in this stuff in the United States. Okay, Lola in Rhinebeck. Lola, you're on.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Dr. Plakin, I have a 11-year-old son, and during this school year, he had to be taken out of school. We actually ended up in the psych part of the ER one night at the insistence of the school principal, for what I guess I'd call meltdowns, when he just really gets whacked out. We just started him with a therapist, but I'm feeling a little unclear about how to understand what kind of therapeutic method therapists use. I don't even know how to ask the therapist to get a better understanding of what he's going to do. I kind of lack the vocabulary to ask the question. And then the other part of my question is, the therapist has already mentioned to me that he considers him an anxious child, and I'd like to do some reading about anxiety in children.
Well, okay, Lola, sorry to hear about the struggle that's going on in your family. I think 11 years old is an interesting time in life. It's right there on the cusp of a big developmental advance around puberty. And, of course, I don't know anything about what other kinds of changes may be going on in the child's life or what the experience in school is. And, you know, that getting to be junior high school, middle school, intermediate school age is a complicated time. Kids can be tough, and there can be issues like bullying going on, or it can be issues at home. There are all kinds of things that can be going on. And, of course, as I've said every time I've been on this show, I'm not here to try to diagnose anyone's situation. But I think you should just use the best language you have to just ask the questions you've asked here. What does this therapist think is going on, and what does he or she think is the best way to approach it? I hope it's somebody who's experienced with in working with children. Ideally, it will include somebody who thinks about medications, although not only about medications with somebody this young. And ideally, it would include somebody who would think about families. Because as people meet developmental milestones, issues that may be going on elsewhere in the family often turn up in a child as the place where the problem shows. But it can also, as I said, be bullying at school and other things. I'm afraid I'm not an especially good resource for lay literature about anxiety in children. I'm an adult psychiatrist, not a child psychiatrist. I'm afraid I haven't got something to suggest. I would just say this about anxiety. Anxiety is a symptom, and it is also like the check engine light on your dashboard. When it comes up, you don't simply want to turn it off necessarily. Mm. You want to get the engine checked. What is it signifying? What is it telling you about what's going on underneath? And I think that's an important issue to keep in mind, especially with somebody who's at this kind of a developmental stage. I hope that's helpful, and I'm sorry I haven't got a book to recommend.
Lola, I am so sorry that we can't give you more time. I've been severely criticized for moving things along, but that's the way I run it. I thank you so much for being here. Thank you. Yeah, bye. Okay, let's go to Dave in... I messed up. Okay, Dave in Shadley. Go ahead, Dave.
South Hadley. Oh, South Hadley.
Okay. Thank you, Dave.
I'm an adult in my early 50s and was recently diagnosed with high-functioning autism, being on the autism spectrum. They don't use the term Asperger's as much anymore, which may be, I'd like to get your opinion whether that's good or bad, that new development of language terms for it. And second, I was wondering your opinion if after a lifelong living with an autistic brain, an autistic life, having difficulty with social, which means having difficulty with social skills and making friends, if that can be reversed, or if not reversed, helped through some type of therapy, and if so, what kind of therapy would you say might be best for adult newly diagnosed high functioning autism when nothing's been done earlier?
Hey, Dave, thank you very much for your question. We'll go to the doctor. Doctor.
Dave, thanks for your question. It raises a lot of interesting issues. So, yes, first of all, it's true that in DSM-5, which came out within the last year, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, 5th edition of the American Psychiatric Association, we did change the way that the autistic disorders are categorized. Really, in DSM-3, the 3rd edition, there was no Asperger's. In DSM-4, Asperger's disorder was introduced and for a higher functioning kind of autism, but still with social deficits, with trouble reading social cues. It's called social reciprocity, sort of getting it when somebody is being sarcastic or joking or not, and difficulty relating. This was done away with in DSM-5 because the research simply was not supporting a hard boundary between something called Asperger's and an autism spectrum. So as you indicated, it's been recategorized as an autism spectrum disorder, where there's a range of things rather than a single set of discrete and separate categories. Now, I think that the approach to autism, and it's interesting, if it didn't get diagnosed in you until you're in your 50s, as you indicate, then high functioning is the right word. And I think there are things to learn if you can focus on what are the areas of deficit and what are the kinds of learning that would help you, overcome those particular blocks. I think that's a way to approach therapy, and I think it's something you wouldn't do in a call-in radio show, but, you know, you would do with somebody who you were speaking with. Sometimes people with autism spectrum disorders have other kinds of symptoms for which medications can be helpful, but they aren't inevitably helpful. Remember, it's a both-and, not an either-or kind of a perspective. But I think there's reason to think that people with troubles on the autism spectrum are important to think about in terms of their plasticity. In the right environment, how can they thrive? And I think that's a question you should try to bring to somebody.
Dave, thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it. Very important call. Okay, let's go to Janie in Hunter. Okay, Janie?
Hi. I have custody of my two granddaughters, just turned 7, about to turn 6. Both parents have mental health issues. My daughter, their mom, probable some form of narcissism, possibly borderline, but also probably has some brain injury from lack of oxygen for over 30 minutes at birth and then heavy drug use. Dad has, it's a schizoid, I forget the name, he just told it to me recently, something that has like depression but also hallucinations and stuff.
It's probably schizoaffective disorder.
That's it. That's it. And also heavy drug use. My concern is that there is mental health issues on both sides of the family. And I started dragging my poor daughter to therapists and stuff when she hit puberty because I could see such a massive difference in her behaviors. And, you know, everybody said she's depressed, but I want to know what I should keep an eye out for these little girls. You know, it's, I don't know what to even, and the questions to ask. Apparently, when I tried to talk to doctors with my own daughter about the possible brain injury from her birth experience, people wouldn't talk to me about it. You know, I always had the sense they didn't want to talk about it because of possible lawsuits, and I would go, look, I just want to know what I need to keep an eye out for and deal with.
Yeah. And okay, Janie, only because of time restraints, let me give it to Dr. Plakin. Mm-hmm. Eric, just before we go, so I guess the question is,
sure.
Should she be worried? Should Janie be worried about what happened to her parents, to the kids' parents being passed on to them? And also, what should you look for to make sure if anything's happening?
Yeah, well, it's a tough situation, Janie. I appreciate your call and quite a complicated issue. You describe a situation with these two little girls, I think you said, 6 and 7,
yeah.
And both their parents are really struggling with more than one thing, you know, personality disorders and brain injury and substance use disorder and schizoaffective disorder. I could spend too much time just explaining what all those different terms mean. I won't do that for now, unless another caller comes back and asks them. But look, remember what I was saying earlier. There clearly is some heritability, but we don't
right.
understand it, and it is not straightforward. Environment matters a lot. I suspect that something rather unfortunate was happening at home if the children were taken away from their parents. But giving them a rich and loving environment is what you can do in a way that provides them with the optimum amount of opportunity for plasticity, you know, for resilience,
okay.
for them to move forward in life and do the best they can with the hand they've been dealt. In terms of what to look for, you know, they're young now. I think you look for how they're doing with friends, how they're doing with you, how they're doing in school, how they're doing,
okay.
You know, and remember that there will always be bumps in the road around puberty. There, if they're not rebelling, you're missing something. So simply the fact that they go through development doesn't mean there's a disaster, but you want to be mindful of times of trouble, and it might be useful to have some family meetings to be able to just speak openly about what they've been through so far if you haven't done that.
Okay.
I know you were being very comforting with Janie, but I have a question for you. I don't really remember my kids rebelling.
well, then you have memory problems, Dr. Chartok.
Could be. Janie, thank you very much. Thanks
yeah.
very much.
Yeah, I have two kids. There was a difference in the types of rebellion.
Thanks, Janie. Okay, let's go to Tom in Albany. Okay, by the way, folks, now there are three free phones, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, and we love your calls. Tom, you're up.
Hi, doctor. I currently use melatonin as a sleep aid, and I do notice the following day after using melatonin that evening to make sure I get a little bit better sleep, it actually affects my mood the next day for the better. And I was curious if you have any opinion or maybe information on how the melatonin affects your serotonin levels for the next day.
Interesting question, Tom. How your melatonin levels affect serotonin levels the next day. Here's how I would think about it. And I'm just it's just the way my mind works. I'm more thinking about how does a good night's sleep affect your mood the next day.
Okay.
And we increasingly, I think, are finding out that sleep is far more important than we had suspected, and that disturbances in sleep can really be the kind of triggers as well as substantial components of psychiatric disorders. So I'm not sure it's a day-to-day shift from levels of chemicals in your brain. I suspect it's a difference in how it feels to get a night's sleep and how, you know, and what it feels like not to. Remember, when somebody is on a drug like, for example, a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, an SSRI, they don't work the next day. They take 2 to 6 weeks to work. And so I'm always a bit skeptical when people tell me I missed my dose and I felt differently. I think that's probably got more to do with what it means to have missed the dose and the reason that they missed the dose than necessarily with a chemical effect of something that just doesn't seem to work that quickly. But I would pay attention, if I were you, to what effect it has on you to be able to get a good night's sleep.
Now, Tom raises an interesting question, I think, and that is melatonin is sold across the counter, right?
Yep.
You're a guy who has been trained to prescribe medicine. Is this a good thing to take this kind of a drug without getting somebody to tell you this is what you need?
Well, melatonin is a naturally occurring substance. Formed in the pineal gland, mm-hmm. and it is involved in sleep-wake cycles. It is used commonly in people to help with sleep, particularly in jet lag situations. And the FDA, which has reviewed the evidence far more carefully than I have, since I haven't at all, has determined that it's not so much a drug as a naturally occurring substance that is available for use over the counter. Just because it rhymes with serotonin doesn't mean it is as potent a substance as serotonin. I'm not especially concerned about it. I've used it myself, but I don't prescribe it.
Tell me about really quickly about serotonin. What is it?
Serotonin is a biogenic amine. It is norepinephrine, epinephrine, and serotonin, which has a longer name of 5-hydroxytryptamine, but it's called serotonin, is one of the chemicals in the brain that is thought to be associated with mood. Now, we believe this without incontrovertible evidence, and I think it's getting far more complicated. But the old amine hypothesis of mood regulation is that when your levels of these amines like serotonin are depleted, you are depressed. And when your brain levels of these amines are elevated, you are elated, as in the mania of a manic depressive or bipolar disorder. This is a nice, convenient hypothesis. It seems far too simple to actually fit the data that we have, but that's what serotonin does. It's one of those kinds of substances.
Great. Tom, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Okay, so now here's the deal. We have to take a short break, seconds. Then we'll talk to Joseph and Carolyn and Andrea and anybody else who's on the phone.
So Support comes from Nathan Littower Hospital welcoming Dr. Alvarez, a gastroenterologist specializing in diseases of the digestive system, practicing in their new gastroenterology center in Johnstown, New York. Accepting new patients, NLH.org. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine-in, takeout, delivery, 518-432-0358. The Urological Institute Urologic Oncology Services, evidence-based comprehensive care for all stages of prostate cancer, featuring UroNav MRI-guided diagnostics to help detect prostate cancer, urologyoncology.com. And from Bethel Woods Center for the Arts, hosting the Mormon Tabernacle Choir in concert with the orchestra at Temple Square, Saturday, June 27th at 7:30, bethelwoodcenter.org for tickets. And from Lotus Energy, Hudson, New York, installing solar energy systems for homes, farms, and businesses for over 20 years in the Hudson Valley and worldwide, lotusenergy.com.
And we are back with the amazing Dr. Eric Plakin, who, as you can hear, really knows his stuff. He's chairman of some of the most prestigious committees, the American Psychiatric Association and all of the others, and has worked for years at the Griggs Center, one of the premier places in the world for the treatment of those people who have some of these problems. So anyway, well, here's the deal, Eric, for what it's worth. All five phones are ringing. I get criticized, and I hate to be criticized, for moving things along too quickly. But, you know, if we can do that satisfactorily, we'll try to get everybody in, okay? Okay, let's go to Joseph in Rotterdam. Joseph, you're on.
Hi, I would like to ask the doctor if he was aware of any studies that showed that children who grew up in single-parent families or same-sex parent families have different problems as adults as opposed to children who grow up in conventional mother-father families.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting question, Joseph. And let me try to answer it this way. I think there is more difference within the kinds of parenting arrangement than between. That is, it is certainly possible for single-parent children and for same-sex parent children to grow up as healthily and normally, if I'm allowed to use that word, as children who grow up in the traditional two-parent family. Any one of us could probably point to two-parent families, heterosexual couples, in which the environment for the kids was horrific. And I certainly could point to the other kinds of situations where single-parent families or same-sex parents seem like they're wonderful environments. I think there's much more difference within each group than between. And I think the emerging evidence is that what's important for kids is to have a loving and secure home with a parent. And that's what's important, not the exact nature of what that parent arrangement looks like. Now, that being said, to the extent that being a single parent means that there was important adversity early in that child's life because of a contentious marriage or financial stress or whatever it is.
Or a death.
Excuse me?
Or a death.
Or a death, exactly. Right. Yes. And whatever there's been, whatever has been the kind of adversity that might have led to that, now that's an issue that's likely to have an impact. And if there's been a contentious issue in a same-sex parenting couple, again, the same thing. But I think that what kids need is parents who love them.
Joseph, great question. Thank you very much. Okay, let's go to Carolyn in Poughkeepsie. Carolyn in Poughkeepsie, you're on.
Hi. Question about, I couldn't catch Dr. Eric's last name
Plakin.
In your pronunciation.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. It's Plakin.
Plakin, and it rhymes with bacon.
Plakin, P-L-A-K-I-N?
K-U-N.
K-U-N. Okay, thank you. The question is kind of twofold. One is that somebody who's had repeated cycles of depression from, say, their 20s, early 20s into adulthood, whether that's referred to as dysthymia when there's no manic episodes, and many, many episodes of this. And the second part has to do with the use of 5-HTP as whether you have experience with it. It's an intermediate metabolite between tryptophan and serotonin.
Well, thank you, Carolyn, for the pharmacologic question as well as the diagnostic question. Let's see what I can do with this. It is quite typical for people with depression actually to have recurrent depression. If they have recurrent major depressive episodes that meet the criteria in terms of duration and severity and problems of mood and problems with sleep and problems with perhaps weight gain or loss and maybe suicidal ideation. If they've had recurrent major depressive episodes, well, that's not so unusual. It's a familiar problem. They say that if you've had one major depressive episode, you have a 50% risk of a second. If you've had two, you have a 70% risk of a third. And if you've had three, you have a 90% risk of future major depressive episodes. Depression can be a recurrent and kind of, if you will, relapsing condition. And that's certainly the case. Now, dysthymia is a DSM-4 term for a less significant depression in terms of its symptoms that is enduring and longstanding. And many people, and it's certainly something we're quite familiar with at Riggs, have what's called so-called double depression, where they actually have the recurrent major depression, and even between the episodes, they're still dysthymic. DSM-5 renames this, and I'm embarrassed to say that I'm not coming up with exactly the new DSM-5 term. It's something like a persistent depressive disorder. I know there's a fourth word that I'm leaving out somewhere.
And that's different from unipolar depression, or could that be called unipolar
depression? No, unipolar is as opposed to bipolar or you know, manic depression. Unipolar, recurrent major depression is unipolar. Only depressed episodes without manic episodes. Now, your question about 5-HTP is 5-hydroxytryptophan, and this is sometimes used as a precursor. Are you talking about using this as a supplement?
Correct.
Yeah. You know, there's not a lot of evidence that this helps very much. The trouble is that there's a blood-brain barrier. Perhaps it's not a trouble. Perhaps it's an advantage, but not every substance crosses into the brain as easily as it crosses into the bloodstream. And nutritional supplements as a way to elevate serotonin levels are on pretty weak ground, as I understand it.
Now, Carolyn's phone hung up, but I want her to know and everybody else to know that you can hear this at WAMC.org. You can hear the whole program anytime you want to hear it. So don't feel bad. Okay, let's go to Andrea in Adams, Massachusetts. Is it Andrea or Andrea?
Either or.
Okay, go ahead.
I work with students that have behavioral challenges, and oftentimes students will be diagnosed with ADHD, and they'll be on Adderall, for example. And I myself take Adderall for ADD that I was diagnosed with as an adult. I was watching television one night, and there was an infomercial guy on there, and he was interesting, and he was stating that there's many different reasons why the brain has the result of being ADHD. And so you have different type of ways to attack it, let's just say. And he said that, you know, there's some common drugs given and they act differently on the brain. And I was wondering if you could talk about the different ways these medications work and why one might be better than another. So, like, I didn't know about other kinds. So it's interesting to me to find out there are different ones that cause different things. Like, I noticed that my focus, even though I have my medication, is not really always as good as I'd imagine it ought to be. And I'm wondering if there is a different medication.
Here we go.
Yeah, well, thanks, Andrea. That's a really interesting question. This whole area of ADHD is an important one. One of the things we're struggling with around ADHD is that, you know, what you'd like to think is that you have a medication that only works if the disease is present. And in a sense, the treatment helps you decide that you had the diagnosis correct. Well, that's unfortunately not so much the case with attention deficit disorder, because stimulant drugs of the sort that are used tend to help everybody concentrate and focus better. In fact, they were originally used during the Second World War in pilots who were on long missions. It kept them awake and focused on the mission. Now, there are a range different medications for attention deficit disorder. They tend to be in the class of stimulants. And, you know, as is the case for antidepressant drugs, often there are just individual differences in terms of the side effect profile, and one drug may work better than another. Some of the differences in the drugs have to do simply with delivery. For example, you mentioned the drug Adderall, and there's immediate release Adderall that people take, but there's also an extended release Adderall that people take that gives you a longer acting, less high peak experience of it. And so some of the different drugs are the same drug as another brand, but arranged as one that can be longer acting. I think that medications definitely have a role in work with people who are struggling with attention deficit disorder. But I think it's important to look at the whole, if you will, psychosocial picture as well, and try to think about what else might be going on. What issues are there in the family? What issues are there at school? What could this be a signal about that needs attention? But certainly there's quite a range of drugs and the drugs are effective. The trouble is, they would help me concentrate better too, and I don't think I have attention deficit disorder.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So when people are being diagnosed with ADD, I noticed that I wasn't given like a list of the other things that I could do that also would help me, like, or whatever. It was like, oh, here, you know, you're the poster child for this. Go ahead and take this medication. So I would wonder why it's not equally as promoted, the other things, like you said, the other things you might look at or concentrate on that could be affecting like a student or a person or myself.
Well, I certainly hope it is. I think that we should make a diagnosis like that in the context of someone's whole picture, their everything they're struggling with, and then settle on the diagnosis in the context of the whole picture. And we often have stressed systems that don't have time to do as thorough a job as is ideal, but I think we should be doing it.
Thank you very much, Andrea.
Well, thanks.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's go to Dee in Glenmont. Dee in Glenmont, you're on.
Hi, doctors. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a long history of major depression, chronic recurrent. Been on meds since I was 14 years old, now 54. I recently was at Abilify was added as an adjunct, and I'm finding that I have a lot of weight gain with it. I've also been on several other antipsychotics from which I gained weight. I'm wondering what else is out there, because I am feeling better, but, you know, the weight gain is too much.
Mm. Yeah, I understand what you're saying, Dee. Thanks for the question. So you're somebody who's had a recurrent major depression. You've really spent 40 years on medications, and what it sounds like has happened is that whoever's treating you has decided to add an augmentation agent, Abilify.
Correct.
And that is, you think that the drug is working, but, you know, we've pushed the dose to as high as we can get it, and so let's see if we can tweak it a little more by adding a second drug as an augmentation agent. And if you watch television, as I do, you know that there is direct-to-consumer advertising about the benefits of Abilify. And is that because it's better than some of the less expensive and older and more traditional ones that aren't as associated with weight gain? I don't think that's necessarily the case. The other augmentation agents that are commonly used are low doses of lithium, the drug that is used in bipolar disorder. It's just a naturally occurring salt. It has side effects. They all do.
Sure.
Also, some forms of thyroid hormone are used as augmentation agents, as are some other drugs, like even the stimulants sometimes, and an anti-anxiety agent known as Buspar. And so there's quite a range of things. And, you know, I don't know the situation. I don't know your doctor.
Sure.
I just know that when I hear direct-to-consumer advertising and the first augmentation agent that somebody winds up on is the most expensive one at Abilify, you know, I scratch my head and wonder how much it's clinical science and how much it's pharmacological marketing.
And I scratch my head when they tell you at the end very quickly about all the things you could die from if you take this.
Well,
oh,
really?
That's true. That's true of the lithium and the thyroid.
Yeah,
you know,
sure. D.
The problem is, I've been on all of them.
I see. Well,
you
know, our drugs work. They have limitations and they have side effects. And weight gain with the current generation of neuroleptic or antipsychotic drugs is a common and significant side effect.
Thanks, Dee.
Thank you so much.
Right.
All right, bye-bye.
1-800-348-2551. Bill in Gloversville. Okay, Bill, you're on.
Hey, Doc. Listen, I'll make this brief, but I've been prescribed risperidone to deal with my situational anger. Now, I wish to take melatonin in order to help me sleep. Is there a drug interaction that I should be aware of with that risperidone and melatonin or any other? I'm taking melatonin over the counter. I haven't begun taking it, but I want to.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Bill. I appreciate it. And I'm so glad that you're asking the question. What I would have to do is I would have to look at one of my interaction checkers that I have on my iPad that I keep with me, and I would double check it, because I don't know of one that comes to mind between risperidone and melatonin. However, if you were my patient, I would want to check it and not simply trust my memory. And I think that this is true for people who are on any kind of psychiatric or non-psychiatric medication. Excuse me. If you're going to use supplements, let your doctor know, and let the doctor do the interaction check, or simply use her or his own knowledge from previous experience about interactions, because we cannot assume that the drugs that we may take as supplements are not going to interact with medications that are prescribed, and possibly in lethal ways. So I'm delighted that you're asking the question, but I think I would urge you to bring it to the person who prescribes for you, and it's the kind of interaction that's easily checked.
What about all those people who do this kind of checking themselves on their computers?
What about it?
Is this a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, informed consumers, I think it's fine for people to know the question, to know the answer. But you can't practice medicine from information on the Internet.
Sure.
There's the issue of weighing what's found. And I don't have a problem with people being informed about substances that are prescribed or that they're taking. I just think they should work with somebody who's had years of training and experience in making the decisions about it, rather than assuming that what may be an overly simplified perspective on it is adequate to make a decision like
okay.
that.
Okay. Thank you very much for your call, Bill. Okay. We'll go to Bob in Saratoga. Bob in Saratoga, you're on.
Yes, I have a question about a head injury. I received one as a child. I had trouble walking. And I'm just wondering what can be done at this late state.
How old are you now, Bob?
66.
66 years old. Well, it's interesting to wonder why at this point this would come up. I mean, people do get head injuries, and it's awful. We've certainly learned from our experience in the Middle East what a serious issue it is to wind up with a traumatic brain injury, and the insidious ways that this can be associated both with some kinds of brain damage, neurologic damage, emotional damage, and post-traumatic stress disorder all mixed up together. I think that when somebody gets to be 66, we also start to think about the other side of brain functioning, which is, what's the contribution of aging? And I would think that if you have reasons to be concerned about some aspect of this, if something after all these years has led this to be an issue, I would go see a psychiatrist about this. And I say psychiatrist because I think you'd want somebody who was knowledgeable about the neurology, the brain effects, and the psychiatric and psychological effects of it. But the good news is that this many years later, you've probably made as full a recovery as you're going to from that original injury.
Hey, I wish to cut both of you off because we're out of time. Thank you very much, Bob. Appreciate it. Okay, Matt from Rosendale. Matt, you have 10 seconds. What's your question? You want me to do it for you?
Quick statement. I think that docs need to explain the side effect of tardive dyskinesia more to their patients. I'm a retired RN, and I come across, and I worked in psych a lot.
Okay, hey, Mike. Hey, Matt.
Over and over.
Matt, I'm so sorry. That's it. Okay. Eric, you got a one-liner?
Tardive dyskinesia is an important problem. Doctors should explain about it more. And much more I can say in a limited time.
And if they don't do it, you should ask them. Okay, we're about out of time. Thanks, everybody who called in. A lot of you did. I'd also like to thank the wonderful Dr. Eric Flaken for joining us today. He is so smart and the top of his profession. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. And I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now, everybody, for a news update.